Welcome back to the Bitcoin Layer. I'm Nick Bhatia. Today, we welcome back Daniel Batten. He is a tireless advocate for Bitcoin and focused on specifically the environmental impact of Bitcoin mining. Lately, he has transitioned his research to include the sovereign wealth fund complex and trying to understand why specifically sovereign wealth funds have a roadblock to investing in Bitcoin. Daniel, great to see you. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be back. Thank you.
So let's start with your overall approach here. Why have you started to get into sovereign wealth funds and specifically their own investment mandates and why they are or are not able to invest in Bitcoin?
I think some of the best discoveries you make in life are accidental, and this was a complete accident where I was interested in who the next group of institutional adopters of Bitcoin would be, was looking at nation states, was looking at pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, Wall Street, and realized that there was $35.7 trillion of assets under management in sovereign wealth funds. So that's a combination. You've got the sovereign wealth funds, and you've also got public pension funds. The third group is central banks. We're going to exclude them because I don't think they're going to be investing in Bitcoin anytime soon. But if you look at those other two categories, that's $35.7 trillion of AUM. And if a 1% deployment into Bitcoin were to happen, we can calculate based on the current ratio of dollar invested to market cap increase that it would lift Bitcoin price to over $148,000. Now, isn't 1% AUM investment reasonable, feasible? Well, that's actually less than a lot of the funds on Wall Street have been investing today, which is in the 2 to 3% threshold. So we know that it's absolutely possible. And so then I just got curious to go, well, why are they not investing? And I stumbled across an interview with Kevin O'Leary on what Bitcoin did a couple of years ago. And irrespective of what you might think about Kevin O'Leary's choice in crypto exchanges, he's pretty good when it comes to his knowledge of sovereign wealth funds. He spends a lot of his time dealing with them. He's one of the people who knows them very well in the world. And he put it very simply, and he said that all of the sovereign wealth funds want to invest into Bitcoin. It's not through lack of want. He said it's through lack of ability. And he said that all of these funds have an ESG investment committee. And right now, none of them are giving a positive tick in the box of Bitcoin's ESG profile. And this got me curious because this is an area that I've spent a lot of time researching over the last 2 years. And I realized that there was a massive, I wouldn't even call it information asymmetry, but a knowledge asymmetry, where the knowledge that we now have about Bitcoin and its environmental benefits is now so different to what the ESG investment committees of sovereign wealth funds believe about Bitcoin, which has been informed largely through information and misinformation at least 3 years old, that if we can collapse that knowledge asymmetry, then we can remove a blocker that has prevented sovereign wealth fund adoption into Bitcoin. And this can be something that potentially adds fuel or even fuels the next Bitcoin bull run. So that got me kind of excited and going down a path of saying, well, let's spend some time on this because this seems a valuable thing for me to be doing some further research on, and not just researching, but starting to meet some of these people at these sovereign wealth funds, talking to their ESG investment committees and starting to understand why they can't invest and what they need to know and what re-education is required in order for them to feel comfortable, not only comfortable with Bitcoin as an ESG asset, but that it actually strongly ticks their ESG box, which it absolutely does.
The Bitcoin Layer is proud to be sponsored by Unchained, the leader in Bitcoin financial services. Unchained empowers you to take full control of your Bitcoin with a collaborative multi-sig vault where you hold two of three keys and benefit from a Bitcoin security partner. Purchase Bitcoin directly into your cold storage and eliminate exchange risks with Unchained's trading desk. Unchained also offers the best IRA product in the industry, allowing you to easily roll over your 401ks or IRAs into Unchained without giving up control of your keys. Unchained also offers the best IRA in the industry, allowing you to easily roll over your 401ks and IRAs into Bitcoin, all while keeping control of your keys. Don't pay more in taxes than you have to. Talk to them today. Go to unchained.com/TBL and make sure you use code TBL for $100 off when you create an account. Imagine losing your Bitcoin fortune to a house fire or to accidental damage. A complete nightmare, right? It's estimated that over 30% of Bitcoin are lost forever, and poor seed phrase security is a big reason why. That is why we use Stampseed, a really cool DIY kit that allows you to stamp your seed into these titanium plates. So let me show you how it works. They send you a titanium plate. Part of the kit comes with this really easy to use tracker. You slide your seed phrase into the tracker. Now you take the letters that they send you, you take a letter out, you place it into your device, and then you take this incredibly heavy duty titanium hammer, and you hammer your letters into this titanium plate. Your full seed phrase will be stamped into this titanium plate that is fireproof, accident-proof, damage-proof. These tools have been specifically designed by people working in titanium stamping for over 14 years. So go check them out today, stampseed.com, and make sure you use code TBL for 15% off of your order. Now, Daniel, the reason that we continue to have you on as a repeat guest here is that your efforts inside the lines and with these sovereign wealth funds and trying to explain to them the misinformation that they have received and converting that into actionable, investable information about Bitcoin. It's so important, especially because with us sitting in our chairs here at home, we already know that Bitcoin is not a danger to the environment or a danger to the globe, that it actually is potential to really benefit our whole energy consumption. You know that that's a theme of our show here and part of your research too. So the reason that we are so excited about your work is that you're the one that's actually going to have the conversation to teach them that, hey, you are working off of incorrect information. Here is the correct information. And the result is the unleashing of trillions in capital that can take Bitcoin's price to several hundred thousand dollars. So it's exciting for us from a price perspective, but you're the one that's going to have the conversations with them. So tell us what the beginnings of those conversations are like, because I'm sure that because you have truth and facts on your side and all they have is obsolete propaganda to go off of, that if they are open-minded, it must be an easy conversation, right? Or am I wrong?
Like a lot of things, the strategy is easy, but the implementation of the strategy is non-trivial. So if I were to go in there and say, hey, you guys have a lot of really obsolete ideas. You've been making bad decisions on bad data for a long time, but I have the source of truth and I've come to educate and enlighten you. You can probably imagine how that's going to go. So it's not enough that you have some information that other people don't. That's why I make the distinction between information asymmetry and knowledge asymmetry. Information asymmetry is tradable. However, you need to recognize that that information is valid, that it is a correct view of the world. Otherwise, you could lose and there's risk. And these people are risk averse. They're managing the wealth of sovereign nations. And so the default position is, if I have two different versions of events about, or two different sources of truth about Bitcoin and whether it's good for the environment and good for people or not, then I'll default to the one which is most common, which is most familiar, and that my peers in the industry have been espousing for some time. So that's what we're working against. So it's not trivial to turn these things around. It requires not just fancy charts and good data and even peer-reviewed scientific literature, but walking people through their misapprehensions and sometimes misinformation step by step. And look, you're in the business of education, so you understand better than most how re-education is actually harder than education, because you're not starting from ground zero with people who are necessarily just curious. You're starting with people who have a certain belief system that, in order to be receptive to new information, needs to be a little bit softened and needs to become receptive, as you say. So that's the hard part. So the strategy is easy. The strategy is a no-brainer. The implementation of the strategy is what's going to be requiring some work.
Understand. So what are those starting points when you say you're not starting from ground zero, but you're actually starting from a negative perspective? What are some of the first battles that you have to fight on the misinformation front? And how do you easily break down, or maybe not easily, but how do you break down some of that information from the get-go?
So there's this new institute that's recently formed called the Digital Assets Research Institute. They're doing some fantastic work and really bringing together a lot of the existing peer-reviewed research on Bitcoin and social and environmental impact, as well as adding their own peer-reviewed research. Fantastic resource. And what they've recently found out is that two things. Number one, and this is celebration time, the media narrative on Bitcoin and its energy impact has changed. And we know that because we can chart over time that the amount of negative to positive has fundamentally changed. In 2021, it was 3/4 negative. Today, it's about 60%, 70% positive. So that's a massive turnaround. However, there's a big caveat to that. Someone from the Digital Assets Research Institute then said, well, let's look at the literature that's been cited. And he found that the negative literature, the negative peer-reviewed journals, had 45 times as many citations as the positives. So what we have to contend with is that backdrop. The analogy that I use is that the media narrative has shifted. So that means that we're no longer poisoning the drinking supply of information that people receive about Bitcoin and its environmental and social impact. However, that doesn't mean that everyone who's been drinking from that drinking supply is suddenly miraculously healed. That doesn't mean that the reservoir that you have, just because there's no more poison being put in upstream, is suddenly purified. It doesn't. So we've got to purify that reservoir of information, and we've got to heal those people who've been drinking from that poor information for many years. So in terms of their starting point, it's incredible, but most people still believe that Bitcoin is mostly powered by fossil fuels, even though that hasn't been true for 3 years. They still believe that Bitcoin destabilizes grids, even though there is the scientific consensus says the exact opposite. They still believe that as Bitcoin price increases, that Bitcoin emissions will grow, even though we have charted data that shows that that's not the case because of machine efficiency improvements and moving to sustainable energy. And we still have people who believe that Bitcoin mining is responsible for the opening up of previously mothballed fossil fuel plants, even though we have data which has debunked that actual security filings and the one Bitcoin mining operation, which was running off a fossil fuel supply being coal, that hasn't been mining off a coal source since 2021. People just don't know that. So part of it is about acknowledging and not making them wrong for believing what they believe, because they're reading the same sources everyone else does. Acknowledging that when I first came to Bitcoin, I thought the same way they did. I thought it was bad for the environment too, because I trusted my information sources. And it was only as a result of doing some independent research that I realized that those information sources were either incorrect or out of date. So going through that same process, step by step, hearing the objections is going to be super important. But that's the starting point. We're not in many cases starting with people who are neutral, but people who think that Bitcoin is negative. And that's the reason they've said to their sovereign wealth fund investment committees, you cannot invest in Bitcoin.
Now, one of our recent episodes that we did together, Daniel, focused on propaganda specifically coming out of the European continent, the ECB and the BIS specifically, to name two institutions that are responsible for some of this negative Bitcoin propaganda. But I want to just bring that concept back here. You talk about the poisoned water supply of existing knowledge on Bitcoin. We can specifically attribute blame to a couple of these European financial institutions for basically stoking this fire. And it's provided a roadblock or a hurdle for us to get through in terms of educating people. So before I ask you the next question, I just want to remind people that this poison supply of knowledge, it didn't just happen to get there. It has been placed there very specifically by financial institutions that feel threatened by Bitcoin or the concept of Bitcoin. And the concept of Bitcoin has a lot to do with the decentralization of power, which is something that Brussels just physically cannot understand. So just to tell people that the information that got there, it didn't just magically appear. So the hurdle that we have is coming from people that are malicious in nature. So I'd let you respond to that.
Yeah, one of the problems that we face is that whenever you have any disruptive technology, this always happens without question. When the automobile came to the fore, the horse and buggy industry didn't just roll over and say, here's a superior technology, let's convert and sell cars instead. They did everything in their power to try to convince people that these things were going to blow up, they were unsafe, and that the horse and buggy was better. When the internet came in, you had telecommunication companies that were threatened because they could lose substantial amount of revenue to voice over IP, trying everything in their power, pulling regulatory levers, creating fear in the marketplace about the unreliability of this technology. The print media attacked them. Everyone attacked them. And there was also a lot of FUD, a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt created about their carbon footprint. Articles in Forbes from dating back to 1999 saying that it's going to fire up all this whole new generation of coal plants. And then everyone realized the utility of the internet and that it was great. And most of those articles were based on flawed assumption about what happens to machine efficiency over time and a whole lot of other flawed assumptions. And people got on with their lives. And so what we're seeing with Bitcoin is nothing new. So we shouldn't be surprised by this. And if anything, it's more pronounced because the people that and the institutions which Bitcoin can disintermediate are some of the most powerful institutions in the world. We're talking about taking power out of central banks because with Bitcoin, you don't need a central bank. It disintermediates them. You think people who have enjoyed the privilege of being able to print money for generations are suddenly going to roll over and say, what a wonderful technology. We're so happy it came along. Of course they're not. They're going to do everything possible to protect their position. And that's going to be pulling regulatory levers, and that's going to be pulling information levers to create blocks. And whether you like their tactics or not, they're not new tactics, and they've been highly, highly effective. And that's why they're using them. And the reason the environmental attack vector has been used so repeatedly has been that it's been so effective, because now you have these whole institutional wealth funds who are unable to invest in Bitcoin. You have Norway, whose parliament is seriously contemplating a ban on Bitcoin mining. And you have Iceland considering similar moves. And you have the EU working with the European Central Bank and ESMA, the European Market Authority, to create policies about Bitcoin, which one of which would be the labeling of it as harmful to the environment. Why? Because then you can create policies around Bitcoin which make it difficult for people to invest and in some cases outright preclude people from investing in it. So it's been highly, highly effective. Now, in terms of the research, there has been some and a lot of institutions who have been innocent, who genuinely care for the environment, and they have read or drunk from this poisoned well of information, you can say. And so they're innocent insofar as they're not creating new misinformation, but they're culpable because they haven't done the research to make sure that the information sources that they're gaining are coming from good authoritative sources rather than vested interest. Now, this question of vested interest is actually really interesting. So Andrew Bailey, who's doing some great work, he's recently written a book called Resistance Money, pointed out something recently, which is as soon as someone who holds Bitcoin says something positive about Bitcoin, then people automatically say, well, of course you're going to say that. You have a vested interest. But if he said, well, that's actually an absurd argument. Wouldn't you like someone who's talking about a domain to be a user of that technology? Would you expect that no one should comment about medical research who's a doctor because they have a vested interest in selling pharmaceuticals? Would we say that no one should do dentistry research who goes to a dentist or is a dentist because clearly they have a vested interest in selling their dentistry products and services? Of course we wouldn't. They would be the very people we'd turn to and say, look, we need your expertise because this is the exact domain that we're seeking knowledge and you have that domain knowledge. But the very people who are most qualified to give their expert opinions on Bitcoin mining have been the ones who have been excluded from the conversation based on this false notion that somehow everyone is conflicted and has vested interest and therefore shouldn't be even engaged with. Now, in reality, of course, everyone's conflicted. You can say, well, you hold fiat currency, therefore you're conflicted because you have a predilection to say that Bitcoin is not going to be performing as well as your fiat instruments. So as long as everyone's transparent about their holdings, then everyone should be consulting. No voice or viewpoint should be invalidated. Just in the same way that even a central banker, whilst we can say, well, you have a conflict of interest, doesn't mean that if they have good arguments that stand up to logical scrutiny, then their potential conflict of interest doesn't mean that their logic is not valid. So we have to actually look at point by point by point. Does the logic make sense? Is this based on sound research? Are the assumptions correct? And that's where you start to find that if you look at the assumptions behind most of the environmental research in Bitcoin, they just make no sense whatsoever. And my consistent view was that when we looked at the people who actually had the knowledge, who knew about renewable transitions, who knew about solar energy, wind energy, who knew about grids, who knew how energy worked, who knew how methane mitigation worked, and they knew about Bitcoin mining. In other words, the informed people who had the domain knowledge to create meaningful insights on the subject, they came to the same conclusion, which was it stabilizes grids, it stabilizes electricity prices, its emissions are not increasing, it helps us mitigate methane where other things cannot do it profitably. And by creating a marketplace where you can sell demand response, in other words, help to stabilize grids where there's excess load, they actually allow you to put more renewable energy onto the grid, which comes from intermittent sources because of their flexibility. And because they can be a customer of that energy from renewable generators, they can make renewable generation more profitable, which proliferates the use of renewable energy on grids. No question, and it's now backed up by the scientific consensus. In the last 2 years, there have been 10 peer-reviewed articles on Bitcoin's environmental impact. 9 of them were showing positive externalities. The only one that showed negative externalities was from UN University, and it was using a data set which was 3 years old.
Absolutely fantastic. And remember, folks, that it's not just central banks that have the power to create money. It's the commercial banks as well, with their deposit banking and their lending money into existence. The fractional reserve system is a function of both the central banks and the commercial banking system working together. So you can't expect the fight against Bitcoin to originate from the incumbents. That includes both the public and the private institutions. And a special shout out to all those people tracking the Wikipedia entry changes that come from these mega banks. We don't know why they do them, but they are definitely trying to control information. Daniel, you talk about the Wisconsin pension fund allocating. We recently heard about Michigan as well. These, even though the numbers are small of the initial investments, the news items are enormous to me. I mean, these are absolute stalwart states in the United States, in the Midwest, so not on either one of the coasts. I just think the decision for these two state pension plans to get involved in Bitcoin speaks volumes. I'm wondering what your thoughts were when you heard about Wisconsin and Michigan.
It's huge. Wisconsin invested, I think, 0.2% of its AUM. So the amount sounds big. They invested a total through Grayscale mainly of, I believe their current position is around $160 million. That's nothing compared to their total AUM. That's literally a dipping of the toe, maybe even the toenail in the water to test the waters. However, even that very small allocation, which should have had a very minimal impact on Bitcoin price, had a major impact on Bitcoin price that day. Bitcoin price moved up $1,000 on the back of that announcement. So what happened was that sort of price movement is not explicable by the amount of new money coming in through the Wisconsin pension fund by itself. What that did is it excited others in the Bitcoin community to say, this is a watershed moment. This is the first time ever, even though the amount's relatively small, but this is the first time ever that a sovereign fund in the form of a public pension fund in this case has invested into Bitcoin. And that excited upward price movement. Now, it would have been a lot larger if it had been a 1% allocation. Of course, it is a dipping of the toe in the water. But now we've had other ones, Michigan, as you say, and I believe there's others that are in the works as well. So we're already starting to see this movement happening. And what's interesting about that to me is that if you look back to 2021, everyone was expecting on the back of MicroStrategy announcing its corporate treasury and El Salvador announcing nation-state adoption, that we would have a swathe of new corporate treasuries of significant scale and a swathe of new nation-state adoption. That didn't happen. We haven't had a second nation. We haven't had a second El Salvador. It's only very recent we've had a second MicroStrategy and nowhere near the same scale. And that's because for nation-states to adopt Bitcoin, it's hard. There's so many things that have to be true for that to occur. And similarly, for a large company to put Bitcoin in its balance sheet, it's hard, which is why so few have done it. However, with sovereign wealth funds who have huge amounts of assets at their disposal, it's not as hard. The blockers, yes, there is a blocker and there is effort to required to go through it. And it is hard, but it's nowhere near as hard, in my view, as convincing a nation state to adopt Bitcoin. So I see this as an area where, whilst it's hard, it's not as hard as other areas. And it's also that there's only one blocker. There's not a whole bunch of them. And in most cases, that is the ESG Investment Committee. In other words, we can be very focused. And if we can start to get different answers from these ESG Investment Committees, then everything starts to move. It's like there's a blockage in the hosing. And we remove that blockage, then we unleash the flow of institutional capital into Bitcoin.
Now, Daniel, I want to ask you about the specific efforts going on with Bitcoin mining on the environmental front. You talk about methane mitigation a lot here and the generation of, well, the initial building of renewable plants that are being built alongside Bitcoin mining operations in order to basically bootstrap operations that wouldn't have otherwise existed. So on the ground, take us a little tour around the world from Costa Rica to Latin America to Africa to North America. What are you seeing on the ground with some of these very, very important methane mitigation projects and renewable energy projects that really take Bitcoin from this negative light to putting it in an extremely positive light and something that we can share with the world and promote to show Bitcoin's potential?
Yeah. So when you're looking from the position of a Bitcoin critic, the first criticism that people have of Bitcoin is it does nothing positive for the environment. And then you show them the peer-reviewed research it says that it does, and the actual case studies are where it has patently helped to bring more renewable energy onto grids, to help to mitigate methane, to reach some of the UN's methane mitigation targets, and to help that renewable transition and the movement towards net zero emissions. And then people will, the critics will grudgingly accept, okay, it's happening, but it's only anecdotal examples. It's only happening from time to time. And so we're at the point now where people, the critics are grudgingly accepting, yes, it is happening. Okay, it's in the peer-reviewed journals. Okay, the grid operators are saying it's useful. The renewable suppliers are saying it's useful. The people who are mitigating methane are saying that it's doing that. Okay, but it's not happening at scale. It's only these these little pockets here and there, and the overall impact is still net negative. So what I'm sharing now is to say, well, these are pockets at the moment, but everything started somewhere. Facebook started with 20 users or so. And what we have to look at is, what sort of growth curve is it on? And you're right, this is not just happening in Texas. If we look at helping renewable energy get onto grids, it's happening in, there's discussions happening with grid owners in India at the moment. There are people in New Zealand already that I know about who are using demand response, who have hydro dams, and in the rainy season, all of that water spills over the edge of the dam, and now they're able to monetize that energy, turn it into Bitcoin. So, which means then they are more profitable. They can pour that profit into upgrading the facilities. They can pour it into proliferating the use of renewable energy. And at the same time, they have arrangements where when the grid needs that electricity, they curtail very fast, which means it gives much more flexibility to the grid operator, such that now they can put more intermittent variable energy on the grid, knowing that they have the shock absorber where Bitcoin can very quickly go off. The other criticism that you get from some people who don't understand the wider context in which grids operate is they'll say, well, sure, Bitcoin is helping stabilize grids by powering down, but it was straining those grids in the first place by drawing so much load, which sounds like quite a convincing argument, but what it ignores is that there wouldn't have been so much generation capacity on the grid in the first place if it hadn't been for Bitcoin mining operations making those variable renewable energy supplies more profitable. So the analogy is more like this. It's like you have a 5-lane highway, and then you have the citizen who comes along, this is the Bitcoin mining, who say, okay, we're going to give you enough money to build an extra lane, which is going to remove a lot of your peak hour congestion problems, and everyone's really happy. And they'll say, well, we do want to use this highway ourselves. However, when it's peak hour traffic, we will take the nearest off-ramp. So what that means is you'll have enough money to build an extra lane, which removes congestion, and we will have a contract with you where we only use that lane where it's not creating congestion. And this is the service that Bitcoin mining has provided for grids around the world now. So, yes, a lot of the expansion that happened when hash rate migrated from China, it went, and again, this is part of the misinformation. People say, well, it just went to using coal in China to using coal at Kazakhstan. And that's a half-truth, because initially some of it did go to Kazakhstan. Some of it went to America. Some of it went to other places of the world. But the hash rate that went to Kazakhstan only stayed there very temporarily. And most of the measures came from Cambridge data, which is still marooned back on January 2022, which was the last time they updated their mining map, when Kazakhstan represented 13% of global hash rate. And of course, because most of that was fossil fuel-based energy, that skews your results considerably. But what most people don't know is that since then, and we know this based on BitRiver data, is that Kazakhstan is representing less than 1% of global hash rate. And most of that hash rate has now gone to places such as ERCOT, which is increasingly using renewable energy, which uses very little coal indeed. It has a much lower emission intensity. It's going to places like Paraguay, Uruguay, El Salvador, places which are 100% renewable energy based. And that's why you've seen this spike and this rapid rise since the migration of hash rate from China, where it's gone from the mid-30s to the mid-50s in terms of its use of sustainable energy. It's happening in grids all around the world now. In terms of methane mitigation, you have 7% of Bitcoin's entire emissions are now mitigated through people who are using emission negative sources of energy. And you might say, well, how's that possible? How can you mitigate emissions through using energy? And this is one thing people don't understand. Most people still think that you can logically go from saying Bitcoin uses energy, a lot of energy, to therefore it's bad for the environment in one breath. And you just can't. Because what we found is Bitcoin, a lot of that energy used is stranded, is wasted. A lot of it's renewable. A lot of it is helping stabilize grid and incentivize more renewable energy. And critically, a lot of it is coming from sources that otherwise would have been polluting the environment, such as methane. And this is one of the things that I got so excited about that I worked with a group of founders to create a company which is specializing in funding Bitcoin mining operations that are using methane that would have gone into the atmosphere and caused untold pollution and contributed to climate havoc. And we're taking it out of the atmosphere and we're sending it where it should be sent, which is to a generator to power Bitcoin mining operations.
This is tremendously exciting. Yes, and not only is Bitcoin not harming the environment, but it actually has the potential to be the largest force of environmental repair that the world has ever seen from a specific industry standpoint. And we also know, statistically speaking, that Bitcoin mining as an industry has the highest consumption on a percentage basis of renewable resources on the planet. So Bitcoin is for the environment. This whole misinformation campaign, it's stale. And as Daniel suggested, we have to do our best to not ridicule the obsolete information, but instead do our best to re-educate, sympathize and empathize with the other side, in that we understand that we understand your concern, but let us explain to you how your concern is no longer valid based on the current data. Daniel Batten, thank you so much for always championing this Bitcoin mining industry, explaining to people how it is actually helping the world instead of harming the environment. Please tell people where they can find your ongoing fantastic work.
Best place to find me these days is on X, so at DS Batten, and you'll see me tweet there from time to time. And then our company is ch4capital.com, and that is specializing in financing Bitcoin mining operations, which are using landfill gas as their power source.
Daniel, thank you so much, and we'll catch you guys next time.
Thank you.